International Transportation is our next case for argument. Mr. Adams, please don't talk until you reach the podium.
I'm aware
of Mr. Adams,
counsel for the appellants. Your Honor, this is a Title VII case. I'd like to start by emphasizing that the opinion of the district court with respect to its portrayal of this case as simply a conflict between two women in a dispute over an argument over a love affair type thing is absolutely false. That's just not what this case is about, and that's not borne out by the deposition. This case is about an H&M employee, a young lady who had a good work record, whose shift was breaking the rules, who was a good worker, and consequently being a good worker, They had trouble coming up with reason to discharge her. The boss did not like her. The boss, Bart Collins, did not like her from the outset. I need to explain the picture at H&M. H&M does contract work for the Union Pacific and Northlake at its classification yard. It has roughly, I believe it was 111 employees there. The company is headquartered in Jersey City. The hierarchy at Global 2, the UP yard, for H&M was it had a yard manager, a boss, Bart Collins, who was the plaintiff's boss. He was the manager of the yard, and his assistant, his wife, was his assistant vice president. They were the executives at this yard. Over them, you went directly to Jersey City, the corporate headquarters. There were no intervening officers or so. So when Bart Collins, the boss, emailed someone, he emailed it to the headquarters in Jersey City. That was the chain of command. Likewise, the personnel department was in Jersey City. And because of that, and because of this flow, I figured, of electronic correspondence back and forth from Global 2 to headquarters, I reasoned that in a case where the manager had been trying ever since he got to work there to find a reason to get rid of the plaintiff, that there would be plenty of emails and electronics correspondence involving my client and what he was talking to her, what he was saying at headquarters, and what headquarters was saying back. At any rate, that's why I put particular emphasis on emails. The discovery was sent to Magistrate Mason. Magistrate Mason quickly advised us, counsel, about his electronic discovery agreed order, which we were required to fulfill, and file an agreed order with Magistrate Mason at the very outset. In connection with that order, I received a correspondence from opposing counsel on November 18th, 2009. It's Exhibit 7. It's page 7 in the supplemental appendix, in which he made representations regarding their emails and their availability. This is covered in the brief, and I don't like to duplicate the brief that much, but needless to say, he made representations that he would provide. Defendant will take appropriate steps to preserve this information. And in the order filed with the court as a result of our conversations, he wrote the order, and he said, with this notice, defendant has taken appropriate steps to preserve ESI of these individuals. Now, my point is, the big picture is ultimately the magistrate, as you may know, entered a adverse inference instruction, which was affirmed by Judge Manning. That instruction reads, at trial, the jury shall be instructed that beginning in July 2008, the defendant had a duty to preserve all electronically stored information, including emails concerning plaintiff's allegations, but did not do so. In addition, defendant is barred from arguing that the absence of discriminatory statements is evidence that no such statements were made. The district court opinion, granting a summary judgment, does not refer to this, even though it's Judge Manning's own order. This is at page 30 of the supplemental appendix. Now, my contention, and I argued all my position consistently lower, was that the facts warranted an instruction barring the defendant from putting on a Title VII defense. And in that regard, I would like to call the court's attention to a recent Second Circuit case.
This case cited in your briefs?
No, it's not, Your Honor, because it's...
a letter with that case?
No, it's a...
Rules forbid the citation of cases that are neither in the briefs nor the subject of a Rule 28J letter. Our rule is no surprises to opposing counsel.
I see. I didn't know that rule. This is a July 2012 case.
Plenty of time to file a Rule 28J letter.
Yeah. Okay. What I want to point out is that it's when the considerations are made for an adverse inference instruction, you have a test that I've outlined in the brief, Seven Circuit cases. But in addition, there ought to be consideration to whether the instruction deters the parties from destroying evidence. It ought to take into consideration restoring the party who's been harmed by the absence of the evidence to a position where he would be if the evidence had been produced. And what Judge Manning did is take a great deal of interest in the internal workings of H&M and how he found them guilty of gross negligence in their maintenance of these records. That's fine, but after looking at what H&M's gross negligence, you have a bigger question involving the proper adverse inference instruction.
Right, and you did not object in the district court to the recommendation of the magistrate judge about the relief that he
I took the position that the judge of the first part of the judge's order affirming the magistrate reads, the plaintiff's request that defendant be barred from asserting a defense as to liability based on its discovery misconduct is denied.
Right, and you did not object to that before the district judge.
Well, I argued before the district judge. I asked for an instruction the plaintiff's request that defendant be barred from asserting a defense as to liability based on its discovery misconduct. I argued and asked for an instruction barring a Title VII defense.
But not in response to the magistrate judge's report and recommendation. You argued that as part of your summary judgment, didn't you?
And, well, yes, but I also, I thought I was arguing it here before Judge Manning, too, because
the record shows that report and recommendation is submitted to Judge Manning, and there's no objection to it, and then Judge Manning adopts the report and recommendation.
Yeah, well, her order reads that my request was denied, so I made the argument there. And I think in any event, that there needs to be a consideration, as I say, in these adverse inferences as to the effect, the greater effect on the party. I would add, as a compromise to this, this recent Apple versus Samsung case has an interesting twist. There, a lot of discovery was produced, and the judge...
What case are you now talking about?
I'm talking about the Apple versus Samsung case, which is widely known in public.
Is that a case in your brief?
No, sir, it's not.
Did you bring a Rule 28J letter?
No, sir.
Then you are forbidden to discuss it. We've been through this, counsel.
I would merely point out that there's a compromise that, that the court might consider in these instructions, and that's to leave the question of the issue here on this, in, on this part of my case is bad faith and willfulness in failing to produce electronic discovery. These people represented in November 18th that they had this data. They represented it to the court. I then asked for this data in March, and instead of producing it right away, they started to nitpick my requests. Finally, after from March through May 27th, we nitpicked over the terms of whether of the electronic discovery to be produced. Finally, on May 27th, they announced to the judge that they have no electronic discovery, and they've produced a total of 30.
Thank you, counsel.
Do I have the 3 minutes?
No, your time has expired. Mr. Stokes.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court, Houston Stokes on behalf of H&M International Transportation. We're here today because Ms. Northington is appealing the District Court's grant of summary judgment to H&M on her one claim, Title VII retaliation. As this Court is well aware, the prerequisite to a Title VII retaliation claim is that Ms. Northington undertook protected activity. In this case, Ms. Northington's deposition testimony and other undisputed portions of the record demonstrate that there is no protected activity. I think it's helpful if we think of it as in three prongs. The first prong would be that the underlying acts, whether it's the alleged harassment in the workplace or the attack outside the workplace, was not unlawful under Title VII. The appellant has admitted as much on page 20 of her brief. She says, Sims' assaults, threats, and vulgarisms were female to female, no discrimination in terms of sex. The second prong, I would say, would be that Ms. Northington could not have reasonably believed that she was objecting to unlawful activity under Title VII. She gives two explanations for why she was being harassed. One, she says repeatedly, I don't know. Or she references the love triangle that she was involved with Shakita Sims and Terrell Maggette. I believe it's the patent case that, that Judge Easterbrook was a part of, which said, if the issue is personal, then it's fatal to being unlawful under Title VII. Finally, the complaints themselves, both the internal and external complaints, do not allege sex or race harassment. On those grounds alone, I believe you can affirm the lower court. The lower court did not move on to address the other prongs, but there are many other reasons why this court could affirm the lower court. One, there is no causal connection under the direct method. There is absolutely no evidence that the complaints were a factor, let alone a substantial factor, in the termination in this case. Two, under the indirect method, Ms. Northern did not meet the legitimate expectations of H&M. H&M had a good faith expectation that Ms. Northington would come to work sober and would submit to a reasonable suspicion drug test. She simply did not do that. Three, there are no similarly situated employees which Ms. Northington could point to. She simply did not point to a similarly situated employee who was treated more favorably. And finally, there is no pretext. Much like the causal connection prong of the direct method, Ms. Northington has pointed to no evidence whatsoever which establishes pretext. On all of these grounds, this court can affirm the lower court. Moving on to the discovery issue, which is essentially a sideshow, Judge Tinder correctly pointed out that Ms. Northington has waived her right to appeal the lower court's adoption of the report and recommendation. However, even if this appeal was not waived, there has been no abuse of discretion in this court because a reasonable person simply can take the position that was taken in the thorough and detailed report and recommendation issued by Magistrate Mason and adopted by the district court. Finally, at this stage, it appears as if Ms. Northington is arguing that the sanction that was entered is an adverse inference instruction and that that should be used in this context on this appeal. That simply belies the face of the instruction, and also the magistrate clearly found that there was no willfulness or bad faith in this case, and in the absence of willfulness or bad faith under Seventh Circuit precedent, there cannot be an adverse inference instruction. Unless there are any questions, I believe I will rest on my brief.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Our fifth case for